Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to this episode of Physicians Weekly podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rachel Giles from Medical Medical Publishers in collaboration with Physicians Weekly. The phrase, quote, prevention is better than cure, end quote, is often attributed to Dutch philosopher Erasmus at around the year 1500 AD. But in the US, most people are more familiar with Benjamin Franklin telling Philadelphians in 1736 that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. 100 years later, Thomas Edison actually elaborated on that, saying, quote, the doctor of the future will give no medication, but will interest his patients in the care of the human frame, diet, and in the cause and prevention of disease, end quote. For the last 50 years, preventative medicine has been gaining tremendous ground, and we're steadily learning more about it using clinical research.
The Physicians Weekly podcast provides thought leader insights on the latest medical news, clinical trial coverage, and advances in medicine and healthcare.
Today's episode features two interviews with an in-depth look at prevention. We start off by exploring new data just published from the groundbreaking CAP2 study, which first established how aspirin can prevent colorectal cancer, and just recently published an interesting plot twist involving resistant starch. In our second interview, Physicians Weekly's Marta Kelly interviews Dr. Nanette Wenger, a clinical cardiologist and professor emerita at Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta, Georgia, and she has authored over 1,300 scientific papers over the span of her career. She is quite the lady. Yet,
oh, do I have a bucket full of research for you.
Stay tuned to hear about buckets of research. But first, I interview Professor John Mathers from the University of Newcastle in the UK about the recent CAP2 study findings. Enjoy listening. Thank you, Dr. Mathers, so much for joining us today. So I really want to talk about prevention. That's the focus of your research. And I wanted to hear more about, well, let's just start with the basics about Lynch syndrome, about HNPCC, and why is this a good model for understanding colorectal cancer in general?
Okay, thank you very much, Rachel. So the story goes back at least 30 years to a time when Professor John Byrne and I were beginning to think about how we might approach cancer prevention. And this was a time when there was a lot of advances being made in the genetics of hereditary cancers, particularly conditions like familial adenomatous polyposis and what was then called hereditary non-polyposis colon cancer, HNPCC, that we now call Lynch syndrome. So at that time, we were just beginning to understand what the genetic basis of those diseases were. And we had an idea that by studying the unusual cases, we might learn more about the common cases of cancer. So we decided to develop a series of studies in cancer prevention using those two conditions, familial adenomatous polyposis and Lynch syndrome. And the paper that we're currently just published focuses on Lynch syndrome. So obvious question is, what is Lynch syndrome? Well, it's a condition in which people have inherited from their mother or their father a damaged copy of one of the genes encoding a component of the DNA mismatch repair system. So we have a whole range of DNA repair systems that look after our genome. And if we have defects in those repair systems, then pretty obviously we can't manage our DNA and we accumulate defects in DNA. And that's what happens with Lynch syndrome. So people with Lynch syndrome then go on to develop cancers in a whole range of body sites from about middle age onwards.
Beyond screening, what are some of the other preventative measures that you have been able to identify, you and your team, in general for Lynch syndrome?
Sure. So I guess most of the focus has been on prevention of colorectal cancer in Lynch syndrome. It's one of the commonest cancers that both men and women with Lynch syndrome get. And in our CAP2 study, we showed that in our long-term follow-up, that people who had been randomized to aspirin had fewer large bile cancers, about a 50% reduction in the risk of colorectal cancer. And that's now been adopted widely, of course, in the UK, in North America and elsewhere, as a treatment for prevention of colorectal cancer in Lynch syndrome. The challenge is that you might be able to do something about colorectal cancer, but there are lots of other cancers that people with Lynch syndrome get. And those are difficult because usually They're not screened for routinely. They're often diagnosed quite late. And of course, if you have a late diagnosis of these cancers, the outcome's likely to be poorer. So the paper we've just published addresses that issue.
And so could you tell me about that study and the paper that was just published? What was the intervention and what were the results?
Okay. So in the CAP2 study that I've mentioned already, in addition to testing the effects of aspirin, we also tested the effects of a nutritional supplement, resistant starch. That's a form of dietary fiber. So everyone in the CAP2 study was randomized in a 2x2 factorial design, either to aspirin or to resistant starch or to both. So we could look at the effects of both agents in the same group of patients. And what we're reporting now is the long-term follow-up of the individuals who were randomized to resistant starch. And what we discovered, and it was a big surprise, was that there was no effect on colorectal cancer. That had been a hypothesis. We thought that the supplement of resistant starch would reduce colorectal cancer risk, but it didn't. But what we did discover was that non-colorectal Lynch syndrome cancers, so the spectrum of other cancers that patients with Lynch syndrome get, they were reduced by about 50%. And particularly, we saw reductions in cancer of the upper GI tract, the upper gastrointestinal tract. So here I'm talking about stomach, duodenum, pancreas, and bile duct. And these are the difficult cancers to diagnose and to treat, and where people with Lynch syndrome often have these cancers diagnosed at a late stage. And that's, of course, difficult for management.
Still, this is fantastic news for patients with Lynch syndrome when these difficult cancers to identify and manage. So will this be going forward as a recommendation in the guidelines for treatment of and prevention of in Lynch syndrome patients?
Well, I think that will be for authorities like NICE, the National Institute for Clinical Excellence, to make judgments about. We produce the scientific evidence. They need then to evaluate that evidence and to come up with recommendations. And that's the process that was used, of course, with the aspirin recommendation. So we hope that they will see this as strong evidence that higher intakes of resistant starch may be helpful in preventing these cancers in people with Lynch syndrome. Of course, it's one study, and we would like to see this being repeated and validated in further follow-up studies. And I'm sure that those who make recommendations about treatment will also be looking for further evidence.
Right. And I know that part of the discussion with aspirin, of course, it was that it was the COX-2 inhibitor aspect of aspirin that seems to probably be the positive element in these results. But of course, the problem with the COX-1 inhibition that occurred with it is that came with some safety signals. Is that the case for the starch supplement as well? Are there safety signals that one must consider?
So a study like our intervention study is not set up to investigate mechanisms. It's a pragmatic trial, and we see our effects on cancer outcomes. We've been thinking, of course, about mechanisms, and although we don't have evidence directly from our trial, we suspect that the effects of resistant starch are through interactions with the gut microbiome. So we know that resistant starch and other forms of dietary fiber are essentially food for the gut microbiome, and that changes the growth of bacteria and their metabolism. And we're particularly focusing on change in metabolism of bile acids, because we think this might explain the reduction in upper GI cancers that we've observed. So one of the things that happens to bile acids when they get into the large bowel is that those primary bile acids are converted to secondary bile acids. And some of those secondary bile acids are mutagenic and can damage DNA and can increase cancer risk. And of course, those secondary bile acids, some of them at least, are recycled by the normal enterohepatic circulation back to the liver and then out into the upper GI tract again. So what we suspect is that resistant starch reduced the amount of those damaging secondary bile acids and so lowered exposure to the upper GI tract to that potential damage. That, of course, will need to be tested in future mechanistic studies, but that's our working hypothesis.
Well, fascinating. But that would also suggest that perhaps there's a broader application of this approach and this intervention above and beyond Lynch syndrome. Would you agree with that? It's really a supposition at this point. I understand that.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you can imagine, we've been looking in the literature for evidence that there might be effects in the general population. Now, there are no studies that we are aware of that have looked at resistance starch specifically on these upper GI cancers. But there is some epidemiological evidence for dietary fiber in general, and evidence from case control studies and a very limited number of prospective cohort studies that higher dietary fiber intake is associated with lower risk of some of these upper GI cancers in the general population. Now, what I'm hoping is that our finding from this clinical trial will stimulate more of those epidemiological studies where people look in large cohorts for links between dietary fiber and, if they can, resistant starch and these upper GI cancers, because it looks like an area of some considerable interest where there might be new discoveries to be made.
Interesting. Is there anything else on the horizon with the CAP2 study? Are there new findings that you're waiting for to mature or are in the process of being published at this time?
So at the moment, we are running the CAP3 study, which is a study where we're looking at different doses of aspirin. So in CAP2, we just looked at a single dose and that worked in terms of preventing colorectal cancer. Now we want to know whether smaller doses would be just as effective or whether a bigger dose might be even more effective. So we're looking at a dose response study in CAP3 and that trial's underway. Just going back to the business of resistant starch and upper GI cancers, I didn't mention that there's some evidence from mouse studies that resistant starch reduces the growth of pancreatic tumor cells. So there's at least some evidence from animal models that resistant starch may be effective against pancreatic tumors. Those are mouse studies, and of course there are always problems in translating from mice to humans, but at least it's evidence in the same direction.
Thank you so much.
That's everything, Rachel. Yeah.
Hello. Today I'm visiting with Dr. Nanette K. Wenger, MD, MACC, MACP, FAHA, who is a professor of medicine with the Division of Cardiology at Emory University School of Medicine. Dr. Wenger, what makes heart health an important topic for women?
Well, we must remember that heart disease is the leading cause of death for women. And obviously, if we want healthy women, we have to have women with healthy hearts. And sadly, that is not the case in these United States. So much of what we're talking about with women and for women is how to keep your heart healthy and what research is needed so we can define optimal approaches to women's heart health.
You referenced 6 heart risks that are unique to women. What are those risks?
Well, let me go back and say that women share with men the traditional risk factors of diabetes, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, overweight, sedentary lifestyle, etc. But even if those are perfect, there are risks that are either unique to or predominant in women. And I think these are things that women and their healthcare providers must understand. First are risks that are related to the menstrual cycle. If your cycle started younger than 11 years of age, or if you had early menopause before 40 years of age, these hormone imbalances and others that have irregular menses increase your risk of cardiovascular disease. So you'll have to be much more precise in the control of the traditional risk factors. Then importantly, there are risks related to pregnancy and childbirth. And you know, in the medical record, often the obstetrical record and the rest of the medical record are separate. So be sure that your primary care provider knows your obstetrical history. Because if you've had hypertension during pregnancy or diabetes, or you required an early delivery, or your baby was small for gestational age, you had preeclampsia, all of these impart an increase in cardiovascular risk. and be sure that your primary care provider is aware of these. There are also risks that are related to oral contraceptive use and to hormone replacement therapy. Then we have to talk about inflammatory and autoimmune disorders. And those are things like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis and scleroderma. And they involve women disproportionately. And all of these conditions are associated with an increased risk of heart inflammation, heart and valve disease, and heart attack. As a matter of fact, at our Emory Women's Heart Center, we have a cardiologist who meets with the rheumatologists, meets the women where they are to discuss their cardiovascular risk and how to mitigate it. Remember, the woman with lupus will not die from her lupus. She'll die from her heart disease. And then, very important, and probably not adequately addressed over the years, is that depression and anxiety are associated with heart disease and at younger ages, much more so in women than in men. And last is that there's certain cancers, obviously, more prevalent in women, breast cancer, uterine cancer, ovarian cancer. And the treatments, whereas they may cure the cancers, they may adversely affect the heart. So again, we work, and there's a specialty called cardio-oncology. We work with the oncologists to see that these wonderful curative therapies, hopefully we can keep from damaging the heart.
Which women are at most risk for heart disease based on their age, lifestyle, and hereditary factors?
Well, certainly I would say all women in the U.S. are potentially at risk because there are very few women that are free of even the traditional risk factors. And what we've seen over the last several years is that we've lost some of the advances of the last decades, and even younger women are having a sedentary lifestyle. They're overweight, they're diabetic, their blood pressure isn't controlled. But most important, they're not aware of their heart disease risk, and they're not aware of the symptoms of heart attack. So again, very, very important issue. In general, and this follows some of the things that we've learned from the COVID pandemic, the women who have the least access to care and information, the women who live in poverty, the women of racial and ethnic minorities, the uninsured women, but importantly, also the young women. And this really is a message to the young women. And what we see is that over the last several years, the women coming to pregnancy are coming to pregnancy with a low level of heart health. And if you were to compare a group of pregnant women with comparably aged women who are not pregnant, the pregnant women have lower heart health. And this obviously adversely affects the health of the mother and the health of her baby.
What suggestions do you have for cardiologists for help in their practice for helping women improve their heart health?
Again, first is that you must remember that when I was in school, heart disease was considered a man's disease, and no one even paid attention to women, even though women were dying more than were men. So again, realizing that the female heart is vulnerable, and women must be evaluated for their risk factors. They must encourage the women in their practice to follow the Heart Association's Life Simple 7, the way to ensure your heart health. Screen for risks. Be sure to check a pregnancy history because that's part of the risk assessment for women, and to realize these other conditions that put the women in their practice at increased risk. And then, of course, the women must know, and they must ask their physicians, what about my heart health? I've heard from the Heart Association that heart disease is my leading cause of death. What can I do to improve my heart health, and what are the measures that I have to take? Lifestyle and or medication.
And finally, is there anything you'd like to see future research focus on in this area? Is there anything you'd like to add in general?
Oh, do I have a bucket full of research for you. I think that what we have to do is do both a combination of research and education and awareness. And we need heart health awareness campaigns, but we need them to be culturally sensitive and appropriate. And what we have to do is have cooperation among the cardiologists, the primary care physicians, and the OBGYNs. Remember, our OBGYN colleagues are in the preventive mode. They do mammograms. They do pap smear. Now they need to look at their women's heart health and to assess it and to intervene. But what we have to do is we have to engage communities in health programs. They probably should begin in the primary school years so that the girls are involved, as are their parents. Now, one of the things that we have to do is advocate for public policy and legislative interventions that address the social determinants of health. Because those social determinants of health include access to healthy food, to public spaces for physical activity, and to high quality prevention and treatment. And then what we have to do is monitor the risk factor data so that we know where we have to go, the populations at risk, how is it that we address them. So I think it's very important that we begin to have research related to the social determinants of health, particularly as it involves women, that we have research that examines the populations that are most at risk, the racial and ethnic minorities. We must have diversity and inclusiveness in our clinical trials so that we study the women who are affected and we know how best to treat them.
Well, thank you very much. This has been a very interesting and informative interview, and I appreciate you taking time out.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.